This is April 14th, 2013, and I'm going to wade into the very important, doesn't capture it, urgent matter of global warming and what each one of us may be able to do to do our part to see if we can't, well, let's just say do our part. It was about a month ago or so that I in a Sangha email I had a little item, save the date for this coming Saturday, 6 days from now, for a kind of an exploratory meeting of how, as a Sangha, we might get better organized to do more than we have been as a group in an organized way. This was prompted in January by a program I heard in January on the radio. It was Bill Moyer's interview of someone, and I, as usual, I only heard a tiny fragment of the interview, but what I heard really got me to sit up straight. It was where the interviewee, I don't even know who it was, but an expert on the environmental movement said that the key is to get organized. In every great movement, what really made it successful, what really got it moving, was better organization, people getting organized. I think his point was that so many of us are distressed, are even in anguish about what is going on to our planet and all of the evidence of global warming and other vast damage to our biosphere, and yet so many of us, speaking of people in general, are not really doing much about it, and I would count myself among those. And so I just felt, okay, come on, we have to air this. We have to talk about it and get together and see what we might do. And this Taisho is a way to, it was a way for me. That's what Taishos often are, is just talking to myself, of just getting focused on this and not settling for, the thought someday that we could have done more and we didn't, I could have done more and I didn't, is distressing. So here we go. I suddenly found myself yesterday and this morning trying to get up to speed on all of the articles and books and all that have been written in recent years about all of this. So I just want to share some of those things with people. One discussion from a magazine called Tikkun, T-I-K-K-U-N. What does that mean? We don't know. I read it somewhere and it didn't stick. I'm not going to get stuck on that. But it's the discussion about two basic approaches to this work. One is the traditional approach, which could be called naturalism, and the other is a newer, some call the new environmentalism, which is based on mastery. So just briefly, two visions of how to relate to the earth or to our environment. Historically, in the ecology movement, the whole emphasis has been on harmonizing with our environment, striving to fit ourselves into the web of ecological interdependence. The other one came about through a kind of a resignation about the nature, about human nature and our how difficult it is for us to change our habits and particularly the habits of greed and laziness, basically. And this one proposes to be more realistic, and it says that, argues that we have to find ways, technological and other ways, to outsmart or work around these massive problems, somehow rise above nature's laws by employing our reason and our technological abilities, reworking the natural order in the service of human betterment, to quote a passage from one of these articles. So this would include technological fixes like recycling, increasing automotive efficiency, there are ideas about earth-altering actions, orbiting sunshades, putting orbiting sunshades up in space that would reflect light, sunlight back, fertilizing the oceans with iron to grow more phytoplankton to absorb carbon dioxide, pumping sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere to impede solar radiation, and let's say that these all, I would say all of these are worth looking into. It may be that we've already gone too far. This is the really distressing thing, is that we may have already exceeded the tipping point. Most of you know that the climate scientists have been talking about this dreaded tipping point where once we reach that there won't be anything we can do. It's just, it gets into this spiral change of the ocean currents and the atmosphere and all, where it's too late to do anything. And so I think these technological things are worth looking into, although the danger is that the law of unintended consequences, where we can wreak havoc. That old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, that out of our best intentions we can marshal our fantastic intelligence, the scientists and technology experts, and do these kinds of things, and then what do you know, it turns out that some terrible things come out of it. As a result, there's a little panel in this book, this magazine, Tikkun. Okay, da. On the cover is the subtitle under Tikkun, to mend, repair, and transform the world. But in this issue that has several articles about global warming, it has a little panel of five photographs. says we've tried to fix the environment before with some successes and notable failures. Even introducing one species to an ecosystem can cause more problems than it solves. And then it shows these five photos of a the first one is a mongoose in Hawaii, and these mongooses threaten native bird populations. The apple snail in Asia carries harmful parasites. Cane toads in Australia threaten native predators. The Rhinocyclus conicus weevil in the U.S. attacks native plant life. And kudzu in the American South, well, we all know about kudzu, outcompetes local architecture. Geoengineers be warned, it says. Other technological ideas is reflective clouds made by vaporizing seawater. Biochar, the idea is to burn and bury farm waste. Ocean fertilization, adding iron. Iron stimulates carbon dioxide eating algae. I mentioned that one. Light-colored crops reflect more sunlight. Aerosols spray reflective particles in the stratosphere. Trees absorb carbon dioxide. Okay, that one we can be sure about. Let's get plant more trees. Who's going to argue against that? One of the few things you could say about the reign of Mao Zedong in China was that under his regime, millions of trees were planted, and this is one of the things that impressed me most the first time I went to China way back in, I don't know, 27 years ago, to see just everywhere we went there were rows of trees that had obviously been planted in a very conscious way. It's a traditional Buddhist thing, planting trees. At the very least, when you have to cut down a tree because it's too old or sick, to consider if you can afford to plant one in its place in your own property. But the other one, that's the mastery thing, and that dovetails nicely with the notion that we are exceptional beings. This is the American sense of exceptionalism, that man is the ultimate end point of evolution, and that we can do anything if we put our minds to it. Well, let's hope that we can in some ways. But I think one that fits much more with Buddhism is this so-called naturalism approach of recognizing our interdependence with things and going from there. Let me just back up a minute, and among the several articles that I scanned yesterday and today was one by Gary Snyder. Gary Snyder was one of the first famous American Zen Buddhists who spent, I think, 8 years, he told me, 8 years in a Rinzai Zen monastery in Japan before coming back and settling in the Sierra Nevadas. He won the Pulitzer Prize in poetry in the mid-70s. And I came across this article called Ecology, Place, and the Awakening of Compassion. Just a little bit about vocabulary here. He starts off his article with the word ecology, but beginning with the word O. So O-E, C-O-L-O-G-Y. He says, I guess it's pronounced ecology, even with the O. Ecology, as it used to be spelled, is a scientific study of relationships, energy transfers, mutualities, connections, and cause and effect networks within the natural systems. Beautiful. I mean, this is just an array of themes that we confirm in the Dharma. energy transfers, relationships, mutualities, connections, cause and effect networks. By virtue of its finding, it has become a discipline that informs the world about the danger of the breakdown of the biological world. In a way, it is to Euro-American global economic development as anthropology used to be to colonialism. That is to say, it's a kind of counter-science generated by the abuses of the development culture and capable of being misused by unscrupulous science mercenaries in the service of the development culture. The word ecological has also come to be used to mean something like environmentally conscious. I made a decision weeks ago that I wasn't going to try to convince this group of the danger of global warming. If anyone denies the danger of global warming as a human-caused phenomenon, then we got nowhere to go with that. A couple other little things from this article of Gary Snyder's. Social Darwinism flourished for a while as a popular ideology justifying 19th century imperialism and capitalism with an admiring emphasis on competition. The science of ecology corrects that emphasis and goes a step further. It acknowledges the competitive side of the process, but also brings forward the co-evolutionary, cooperative side of interactions in living systems. I'm going to jump over now to something else I found on ecobuddhism.com, great website. This is an article by Frances Moore LaPaix. She wrote the book Diet for a Small Planet many, many years ago, maybe 30 years ago, which offers a strong case for adopting a vegetarian diet, which, by the way, is widely by people in the ecological movement the Union of Concerned Scientists and other groups say the single most effective thing you can do to correct global warming is to adopt a plant-based diet, a vegetarian diet. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, the meat industry generates more greenhouse gases in the form of methane and nitrous oxide. It generates more greenhouse gases than all forms of transportation combined, the meat industry. For those of you who haven't found other reasons to stop eating meat, just consider that. This Frances Moore LaPaix. I've left Gary Snyder's article. This one's called Free Your Eco Mind by Frances Moore LaPaix. Gradually it's dawned on me, we humans are creatures of the mind. We perceive the world according to our core, often unacknowledged assumptions. They determine literally what we can see and what we cannot. Nothing so wrong with that, perhaps, except that in this crucial do-or-die moment, we're stuck with a mental map that is life-destroying. And the premise of this map is lack, not enough of anything, from energy to food to parking spots, not enough goods and not enough goodness. In such a world, we come to believe it's compete or die. The popular British writer Philip Pullman says, we evolved to suit a way of life which is acquisitive, territorial, and combative, and that we have to overcome millions of years of evolution to make the changes we need to avoid global catastrophe. And then she says, if I believe that, I'd feel utterly hopeless. How can we align with the needs of the natural world if we first have to change basic human nature. Fortunately, we don't have to. A new way of seeing that is opening up to us can form a more life-serving mental map. I call it eco-mind, looking at the world through the lens of ecology. This worldview recognizes that we, no less than any other organism, live in relation to everything else. As the visionary German physicist Hans-Peter Dürr puts it, there are no parts, only participants. That's one that stuck with me. There are no parts, only participants. As part of this shift, breakthroughs in a range of disciplines are confirming what we already know about ourselves, if we stop and think about it. That humans are complex creatures, and what we do, from raising children to caring for elders to sharing with our neighbors, exhibits at least as much natural tendency to cooperate as to compete. Cooperate. The view that our species is basically brutal defies the evidence. And this is an archaeologist, Jonathan Haas, of the Field Museum in Chicago. There is a very tiny handful of incidences of conflict and possible warfare before 10,000 years ago, and those are very much the exception. She says, our species has a vastly longer experience evolving in close-knit communities, knowing our lives dependent on one another. The result is at least six inherent traits we can foster once we learn to navigate the world with the map of eco-mind. And she mentions these, cooperation, empathy, fairness. But getting back to the cooperation mentioned in Gary Snyder's article, it turns out that cooperating and co-creating explain our evolutionary success just as much as competition does. No wonder neuroscientists using MRI scans discover that when human beings cooperate, our brain's pleasure centers are as stimulated as when we eat chocolate. Hooray! And what were the evolutionary pressures that turned us into cooperators? In her 2009 book, Mothers and Others, University of California anthropologist Sarah Blaffer, H-R-D-Y, you try that one, H-R-D-Y, challenged the accepted belief that our penchant for cooperation emerged through bonding to fight our neighbors. No, she says. Over most of the 200,000 years we've been around, there were simply too few of us to warrant fighting over territory. Instead, our capacity for cooperation evolved in response to our unique breeding culture. While other primates generally don't trust others to care for their infants, humans have long turned to aunties, grandmas, and friends to help care for their babies from birth. With these helpers, children have the luxury of growing up slowly, building stronger bodies, better immune systems, and in some cases, bigger brains. Hardy surmises. It is this capacity for cooperation honed through shared child-rearing that most distinguishes Homo sapiens, claims Hardy. Back to Gary Snyder for just a little bit more. So he was saying that the science of ecology corrects this notion about brutal competition and acknowledges the competitive side, but also brings forward the co-evolutionary, cooperative side of interactions in living organisms. She also, the second trait that she mentions that we have going for us in this effort to save ourselves and the planet is empathy, and he mentions the intimate perception of interconnection, frailty, inevitable impermanence, and pain is an experience that awakens the heart of compassion. It is the insight of bodhicitta that Shantideva wrote of so eloquently. It is the simultaneous awakening of a personal aspiration for enlightenment and a profound concern for others. will just say this much about the gravity of the situation we're facing. These are statistics I found combing through the literature. We're losing 30,000 species a year. This is being called the sixth period of mass extinction in the history of the Earth. There's some things I got from an article by Amala Sensei in the 2010 issue of Zenbo. The title of the issue is "The Great Turning," referring to the shifting consciousness toward our relationship to what we imagine to be not self. This great turning, Joanna Macy says, there are three aspects to it: the shifting consciousness. The second is doing what we can to slow the damage to the earth, to so we can buy time and save some lives, save some ecosystems. And the third is educating ourselves. I could also suggest it's the opposite, starting by educating ourselves, and then from that comes learning what we can do to slow the damage to the earth and buy some time. The problem is that when we start to inform ourselves about what a horrifying trajectory the world is on in terms of the prospects of global catastrophe, can leave us so disheartened, in despair, actually. I think Joanna Macy was one of the first to identify this handicap, this impediment to more of us getting involved, when she focused on this sense of powerlessness we have, or helplessness. I mean, we're talking here about these incomprehensible forces at work in the oceans and the atmosphere, and it's also complex. And we hear, despite all the overwhelming evidence of global warming, then we continue to see cold winters and cold springs, let's face it, and it's all so mysterious, and it's so easy to throw one's hands up and just take a deep sigh and just say, all right, I'll just keep sitting. That's the most important thing, and arguably it is the most important thing, because the sources of an environmental depredation are the basic three poisons of human nature: greed, anger, and delusion. And so when we're doing Zazen, we are addressing the root cause of it. And I think that's why I have not done more, not gotten more active in doing more, because I have no doubt that we can do all kinds of things, but the fundamental problem is ego, to maybe put it in oversimplified terms. The fundamental problem is this illusion of the environment being out there and I or us being here. Humans here, the rest of the environment out there. I'm here, the rest of the environment's out there. This delusion of division is the fundamental problem. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But back to this real, I think, serious impediment for us getting involved is this feeling of powerlessness, of helplessness, of disillusionment. We those of us who see the enormity of this situation, then we see how reluctant our government is to step in and have the courage to pass laws that will begin to reverse this process, to rein in these forces. It's just stunning to see how many politicians, how many state senators and congressional representatives and the president and the, just name everyone, just in terms of elected officials, how much more weight they seem to put in getting reelected than in saving, doing what they can to start reversing or reining in this process, slowing it down. Here's another article I found on ecobuddhism.com called The Ecological Unconscious by Daniel Smith. He begins with a word I've never heard of, solastalgia. So like nostalgia, but starts with S-O-L-A, solastalgia. In 2004, the Australian philosopher Glenn Albrecht described a hitherto unrecognized psychological condition for which he coined the new term solastalgia. It describes a form of, quote, pain experienced when there is a recognition that the place where one resides and that one loves is under immediate assault, a form of homesickness while one is still at home. It has been used to describe the experiences of Canadian Inuit communities coping with the effects of rising temperatures, Ghanaian subsistence farmers faced with changes in rainfall patterns, and refugees returning to New Orleans after Katrina. In all these cases, the pain of people exposed to environmental change was exacerbated by a sense of powerlessness. Albrecht is now Dean of the School of Sustainability at Murdoch University in Western Australia. Take a look out there, he says, gesturing to a line of coal ships. What you're looking at is climate change queued up. You can't get away from it anywhere. And that's exactly the point. That's the end of his statement. And then Daniel Smith continues. Solastalgia is a global condition, felt to a greater or lesser degree by different people in different locations, but felt increasingly given the ongoing degradation of the environment. As our environment continues to change around us, the question is, how deeply are our minds suffering in return? In 2009, this is a continuation of the article, in 2009, the APA, American Psychological Association, released a report titled Interface Between Psychology and Global Climate Change. 7 out of 8 task force members were scientists who specialize in decision research and environmental risk management, and media coverage of the report focused on the habits of human behavior and thought that contribute to global warming. Janet Swim, a Penn State psychologist and the chairwoman of the task force, states that we must look at the reasons people are not acting in order to understand how to get them to act. But the document also addresses the emotional costs of ecological decline, anxiety, despair, numbness, grief, and a sense of being overwhelmed or powerless. Another member of the task force, clinical psychologist Thomas Doherty, is the most prominent American advocate of the growing discipline of eco-psychology. And this is another person, Patricia Hasbach, who says, if you look at the beginnings of clinical psychology, the focus was on intrapsychic forces. Then the field broadened to take into account interpersonal forces, such as relationships and interactions between people. Then it took a huge leap to look at whole families and systems of people. Then it broadened even further to take into account social systems and social identities like race, gender, and class. Eco-psychology seeks to broaden the field again to look at ecological systems, to take the entire planet into account. Eco-psychology emerged in the 1960s in response to the isolation and malaise infecting modern life. It was taken up by practitioners of alternative therapies in the 1990s and strongly influenced by Theodore Roszak's book, The Voice of the Earth, in which he criticized modern psychology for neglecting the primal bond between humans and nature. And now I'm jumping over to yet another article, this one by Theodore Roszak, called Eco-Psychology and the Ecological Unconscious. I've got an eye on the time, don't worry. I've already figured out I got to go to a second Tay show on this, so hang on. This is an article by Theodore Roszak called Eco-Psychology and the Ecological Unconscious. Roszak, some of us remember his name from the 1960s and 70s. He died a couple years ago, but he was a really formative thinker in the whole movement of the countercultural movement. He's a sort of a cultural scholar. He came up with the term. He's the first to use the term counterculture. And he starts off by saying the nature of sanity. Funny how psychiatrists are absolutely inspired when it comes to mapping sexual dysfunction, but fail to chart the strong emotional bond we have with the natural habitat. It's time for an environmentally based definition of mental health. So the next time you're feeling down, take yourself off to the woods for a few days. I think there's a lot of wisdom to that. How many of us get out into nature enough? I once attended a meeting where the featured speaker was the head of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation. After detailing the ways in which big darns have devastated natural watersheds and riverine cultures, he ended with an appeal. Somehow, we have got to convince people that projects like this are crazy. There was applause all around. Crazy, this is Roszak, crazy. In the presence of environmental horrors, the word leaps to mind. Depleting the ozone is crazy. Killing off the rhinos is crazy. Destroying rainforests is crazy. Our gut feeling is immediate. The judgment made with vehemence. Crazy is a word freighted with strong emotion. Inflicting irreversible damage on the biosphere might seem to be the most obvious kind of craziness. But when we turn to the psychiatric literature of the modern Western world, we find no such category as ecological madness. The APA lists more than 300 mental diseases in its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM. Among the largest of DSM categories is sex. In mapping sexual dysfunction, therapists have been absolutely inspired. We have sexual aversion disorder, female sexual arousal disorder, hypoactive sexual desire disorder, gender identity disorder, transient stress-related cross-dressing behavior, androgen insensitivity syndrome, fetishism, transvestic fetishism, voyeurism, Froderism? I haven't heard that one, much less done it. And pedophilia. Granted, the DSM bears about the same relationship to psychology as a building code bears to architecture. It is nonetheless revealing that the volume contains only one listing remotely connected to nature, seasonal affective disorder, a depressive mood swing occasioned by seasonal changes. Psychotherapists have exhaustively analyzed every form of dysfunctional family and social relations, but dysfunctional environmental relations does not exist, even as a concept. Since its beginning, mainstream Western psychology has limited the definition of mental health to the interpersonal context of an urban industrial society, marriage, family, work, school, community. All that lies beyond the citified psyche has seemed of no human relevance, or perhaps too frightening to think about. There it is. And then he quotes Freud, "Nature is eternally remote. She destroys us coldly, cruelly, relentlessly." Whatever else has been revised and rejected in Freud's theories, this tragic sense of estrangement from nature continues to haunt psychology, making the natural world seem remote and hostile. Now, a number of psychologists have begun to place their theory and practice in an ecological context. Already, eco-psychology has yielded insights of great value. For one thing, it has called into question the standard strategy of scaring, shaming, and blaming that environmentalists have used in addressing the public since Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. There's evidence this approach does more harm than good, especially if, as eco-psychologists suggest, some environmentally destructive behavior bears the hallmark of addiction. Take consumption habits. In eco-psychology workshops, people frequently admit their need to shop is crazy. Why do they buy what they do not need? A common answer is, I shop when I'm depressed. I go to the mall to be among happy people. Buying things is strictly secondary and in fact does little to relieve the depression. Some eco-psychologists believe that, as with compulsive gamblers, the depression that drives people to consume stems not from greed, per se, but from a sense of emptiness. This void usually traces back to childhood experiences of inadequacy and rejection. It may have much to do with a typically middle-class need for competitive success. The insecurity born of that drive may grow into a hunger for acquisition that cannot be satisfied even when people have consumed so much that they themselves recognize they are behaving irrationally. If the addiction diagnosis of overconsumption is accurate, then guilt-tripping the public is worse than futile. Faced with scolding, addicts often resort to denial or hostility. That makes them prey for anti-environmentalist groups, which persuade an aggravated public to stop paying attention to, quote, eco-fascists who demand too much change too quickly. I like to think that these people who deny global warming and will fight every effort toward greater sustainability and every effort to rein in the great forces, great corporate forces of coal and other interests that are perpetuating this terrible spiral we're in, I like to think that it's too painful for them to face up to the real danger, that their opposition to even the most mild changes that most of the other countries in the world have signed on to, that their opposition to that comes from denial, which itself comes from the anguish of facing the problem head on. As every therapist knows, addictive behavior cannot be cured by shame, because addicts are already deeply ashamed. Something affirmative, environmentally benign, must be found to fill the inner void. Some eco-psychologists believe the joy and solace of the natural world can itself provide that emotional sustenance. Some, therefore, use wilderness, restoration projects, or gardens as a new outdoor office. I think this is as good of a place to stop as any. I have a lot more for next week, a lot more directly drawn from Buddhism, Buddhist texts, and even koans, Zen koans, that speak directly to this fundamental delusion of self and other, that any blind misuse of the environment grows out of. But our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows. So just one last thing about the meeting on Saturday. I don't know what's going to happen there. I don't think I need to know. Does anyone need to know? We're going to just talk. Anyone who wants to come to that, we'll just talk and see what we might do. And I see it as just the first of many meetings. So if you can't come on Saturday but you wanted to, there'll be more meetings. And let's see what we can do together as a Sangha.